Hey, Bill.
Hey Matt, you're there.
I'm here.
I didn't expect to see you here.
I'm here. I'm here. I made it through Thanksgiving. Did not have to perform
How was the
Alice's
holiday?
Restaurant. It was good. It was good. Very good. Quiet, nice. How about you?
Good times. No nap baby, something you'll I'm sure experience soon enough.
Yeah, I'm getting on my sleep now while I can. So,
What's your countdown? How many days
I think
left?
it's supposed to be January 23rd. So now I'm at the point where I can say next month, but it's still more than a month away.
Ours was 2.5 weeks early.
Wow. See, I'm really hoping to make it into. I don't know if we talked about this. I'm hoping to make it to 2011 because, the whole Malcolm Gladwell Outliers book, which says that people born in the beginning of a year are disproportionately successful compared to people born at the end of the year. So I figure if the child is born in January, much better shot than if he's born in December. So we're gonna wait.
Try to hold it in.
Yeah, luckily, I mean, it's not really. The due date isn't early in the month, so I think we'll be okay.
I think you'll be okay, but definitely don't treat that due date like it's sacrosanct. That's all my
Yeah.
advice to you.
Speaking of due date, have you seen? Isn't there a movie Due Date? I know I saw it. Is that the name of the movie?
With Steven Carell and oh
No,
no, this is the guys who do The Hangover.
this is like The Hangover. Yeah, I
You
saw
know,
this
as you'll
movie.
also learn, I haven't seen a movie in a year, so I barely know what's going
Well, if
on.
you've seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, you've essentially seen this movie too. So it's sort of like a dirtier version of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So,
So you're giving that a thumbs down then?
I mean, it's Netflix it. I wouldn't pay $10 or whatever it costs to see a movie to see it, but I did, but I wouldn't again. But I would Netflix it,
So I think there is this little tax cut deal issue that seems to be kind of kicking around in the blogosphere.
Yeah, I think it sucked up all the oxygen this week. I mean, actually there's a lot going on, but the tax cut compromise has by far been the top story. Not even close,
Now,
I would say. In
there's
terms of
clearly
political
been
news, I mean, I guess the one thing is the Elizabeth Edwards dying. I mean, she definitely that got a lot of attention for a day or so. But in terms of policy, the tax compromise has been where it's at.
Now, there's been a lot of media attention about what the left is saying, which is very rare. The left gets so much media attention, but they tend to when they're criticizing members in their own party. I guess I haven't heard as much about what conservative bloggers are saying about this deal. Is there general acceptance of it? I know that Sarah Palin has already tweeted effectively opposition. I don't know if she quite literally said it, but had only negative things to say. Whereas most of the media coverage has been that most Republican office holders were expected to vote for it, but is there anything in the conservative blogosphere that might challenge that notion?
So Jim Garrity had a reader wrote in saying, where's Sarah Palin? Where's Mitt Romney? Where's Huckabee? Where's Newt? Where's Plenty? And Garrity over at National Review says, the reader isn't quite right. I noticed on Twitter Palin has retweeted a link to an interview by Jim DeMint expressing skepticism.
I think
So
Newt and Huckabee are for it.
that may maybe I've not seen that, but. It may be. Garrity goes on to say, I see nothing on the issue yet from Romney's PAC, nothing on newt.org, nothing on the site for Tim Pawlenty's PAC, nothing on Huckabee's site. Hot Air yesterday had an interview with DeMint, and actually I wrote about this at Politics Daily. Jim DeMint did an interview on the Hugh Hewitt radio show where he was critical of this deal, but he said, I haven't said anything because I've just been like laying back, letting the Democrats attack it first. So I think that's part of the deal. Even conservatives or Republicans who weren't too keen on it have just tried to like stay out of the con let the Democrats, let the liberals fight over it. So I think conservatives have been reluctant to get involved. And the Club for Growth basically said, Dave Weigel over at Slate reported, the Club for Growth said that they weren't happy with the compromise, but they wouldn't use a vote for the compromise against people in primaries. So that maybe sums up where a lot of conservatives are.
Well, I guess because there hasn't been a lot of attention about it and not a lot of people on the right in office issuing statements one way or the other, I imagine that makes it a little more difficult to get a firm sense of where the headcount is. Obviously, some Democrats are not going to vote for it, but you don't necessarily know how many you can afford to lose and still get the deal passed.
Yeah, I haven't seen any sort of a whip count. And presumably, McConnell presumably and the Republican leadership who were negotiating. And keep in mind, I mean, this, as you know, Bill, I mean, this has nothing to do with Speaker Boehner. I mean, this is the lame duck, you know. This has to be done before going into, into next year's session. And so Republicans are in the minority during this lame duck session in the House and
the
Senate.
But they also, I mean, you tweeted that, maybe you blogged as well.
Yeah.
That Obama's, credibility is on the line here, that if he can't deliver Democratic votes for this deal, then he's quote unquote toast. The same could be said for Boehner and McConnell too. Presumably they have to show that they can actually bring their own members along for any deal if Obama and Boehner and McConnell are going to get together next
right.
year.
Well, I mean, your credibility,
accomplish anything.
Your credibility as a negotiator. I mean, how can you negotiate in good faith if you can't presumably deliver on what's negotiated? So it is a problem for both sides. I think it's a bigger problem for Obama for a variety of reasons. I think that if Obama, if the Democrats scuttle this, and by the way, there was a voice vote in the House today among House Democrats. I don't know the nuances, but basically it was a vote that said they're not happy and they want to change the
I think the key word there is voice vote.
Right. So
not
binding.
Vote.
It's not binding.
And so that vote was to say that we are telling the speaker not to bring this to the House floor as is.
Right.
But there is no as is. There's a framework that was negotiated, and it's now the House and Senate's job to translate that into legislation, which the Senate is now having the head start in. And so that gives folks a whole lot of wiggle room to say whatever was actually produced was somehow different in some way. You have 54 House Democrats who actually put their names on something, saying that they disagree with this and that.
And most of them disagree with making the Bush tax, extending the Bush tax cuts for 2 years. I mean, that's fundamentally the problem for everybody.
Well, a lot of
their focus
has been on the estate tax part of it.
You're right. Actually, that has been, I think that's actually been more in the last 24 hours I've picked up on that. But yeah, that's a good point.
Because basically what they did was, just for folks who don't totally get it, what Bush did in his tax cuts were to gradually wind down the estate tax to zero.
By the way,
as of 2010, it is at zero.
Jane Hampshire and Lawrence O'Donnell got into a fight about this on Lawrence O'Donnell's show the other night.
Is that right?
Yeah, if you go to fire...
O'Donnell has made himself a bit of an enemy of the liberal blogosphere.
It's really weird. Like, number one, he only has liberals on. I mean, so it's like... Lawrence O'Donnell, a socialist, against Jane Hampshire and Ezra Klein and what's his name from Florida. And yet I don't understand why anybody goes on his show, because he's going to ambush you. He's going to ask you, trivia questions, which you should know the answers to. But still, it's a way to make somebody look stupid. I don't know why people go on there.
Well, why does anybody go on a show that's not friendly turf? Because confrontation can be YouTube clips, and YouTube clips can be notoriety, and notoriety can be spun in all sorts of different ways. So,
yeah, but there's one thing to have a fight, and there's another thing. Like, do you remember there was a guy who was like a conservative radio host, and he went on Hardball with Chris Matthews, And he was talking about, like, Neville Chamberlain. And Chris Matthews started really pressing him, like, do you really know what, you know, about... Chris Matthews is trying to essentially argue that he didn't know about the Sudetenland or, you know, the nuances of this, and that he was throwing around Chamberlain without really knowing the history behind it. I understand it, but, I mean, if you're a host and you're trying to make your victims look like victims, your guests look stupid by pulling out, like, trying to prove that you don't know what the tax rate is, the lowest level tax rate or whatever. I mean, I just don't know how you continue to get guests when you're going to play that game. But that's neither here nor there.
Right. And I don't get too far into the O'Donnell stuff. I want to get back to the estate tax. But, you know, even though O'Donnell said in this one confrontation he had with Glenn Greenwald that he is a socialist, you know, that was sort of a glib comment on O'Donnell's part. He essentially has been presenting himself as sort of the political pragmatist, yeah, and making the cases for the need to compromise and the like, and therefore he's been treated as a, you know, establishment pundit by you know, Glenn Greenwald most notably, and I take it he sort of extended that. That came out of his post election.
Yeah, that was on Morning Joe, by the way. I put that. I think I blogged about that at Politics Daily too.
I take it that's extended to the estate tax debate. I haven't watched the show lately because I'm a cable cutter. But
basically, I mean, just to quickly wrap up what happened, it's like so Lawrence O'Donnell was arguing that the estate tax was lower during Bush's final year, and Jane was saying that it wasn't. I think she was actually right.
Yeah, Jane's right.
It went to zero in 2010, but Bush wasn't president in 2010. That's essentially the argument.
So, and where the congressional debate had been was, and forgive me if my numbers are not a dead right.
Oh, you will be held to account for these numbers, Bill. You're now going to be on video.
I believe that because in 2009, the way the Bush tax cuts were constructed, 2009, the estate tax had an exemption up to $7 million. So your first $7 million of your inheritance is tax-free. And then above that, it was taxed at a 45% rate. And then at the this year, 2010, it's just zero. There was no estate tax. And then in 2011, under the Bush tax cut law, it goes all the way back up to where it was in 2001, which I think was only a $1 million exemption. And I forget what the tax rate was. Maybe it was 55.
It's pretty much academic for me, Bill. I don't know that I'm going to make it to the $7 billion cutoff. So,
are you sure? Because I think every American gets hit by the estate tax, from what I understand.
I don't know if I'm going to make it to the $7 million bracket.
Maybe. The House earlier in this past Congress passed a bill that said, let's keep it at the 2009 level. $7 million exemption, 45% tax rate above that. Still a cut from where it was 10 years ago, but you still have an estate tax. And that wasn't good enough for the Republicans in the Senate and a handful of Democrats. And there was a bipartisan bill from Senators John Kyle and Blanche Lincoln that made a $10 million exemption, just for couples, not individual estates, and then a 35% rate above that, and that is the level that is in the Obama GOP compromise.
Yeah,
and so that's what has the House Democrats now furious. At least that's the part of it that they've been most vocal about, and they seem to be trying to make a play to tweak that. And, you know, whether it works or not, obviously, is unknown. But the message from the White House seemed to be, look, this is not significantly negotiable at this point. To get it back to blogging, you know, the prominent voices in the liberal blogosphere are almost uniformly opposed to the deal. Daily Kos now has an email action operation that was agitating to kill the deal. There was a similar joint effort by Move On and Democracy for America and Credo. Move On, you know, has not been, you know, the most strident voice in the online activism world towards Obama. But they went straight to a, you know, kill the deal position. Progressive Change Campaign Committee already was advocating against this before the final deal was struck. Even though there are assorted voices on the left that were actively for the deal, myself being one of them, Tim Fernholz at the American Prospect, Steve Kornacki at Salon, it seems like the fact that there was so much virulent criticism online quickly had an impact in the House Democratic Caucus, to the point where they are now actively saying they are willing to refuse to even put it on the floor, whether they follow through with that or
not. And let me say, as I wrote about, Bill, if Democrats scuttle this, then I think it is devastating for Obama because, number one, how can he in good faith negotiate with, you know, Republicans and Democrats going forward and promise anything that he can sensibly deliver? But it also gives Republicans this, and I don't know if they'll be able to capitalize on it because they're typically inept, but they could essentially, you know, have a message that says, look, we reached across the aisle and we negotiated a deal with President Obama that would have extended unemployment benefits and would have, you know, cut taxes for all Americans, and Democrats in Congress, you know, spoiled that deal. They're so interested in playing politics, and we had this bipartisan compromise, and we wanted to work with President Obama. I mean, it seems to me that I just don't see how Democrats can win that argument. That's such a compelling argument.
There's definitely a strong notion on the left. I mean, that I'm oversimplifying because, again, it's not a uniform position, but those on the left who are critical, this feeds into this whole narrative that Democrats don't stand up for themselves enough and don't drive a hard
bargain. They have an inferiority complex about that, Bill. Democrats have an inferiority complex
about
being tough, and so it makes them
do stupid
stuff.
They have internalized this notion that if only Obama was willing to call the bluff.
Right.
Okay, I dare you, House Republicans and Senate Republicans, to let's let the clock run out. All the tax cuts are going to come up. You're going to get the blame for holding middle-class tax cuts hostage in deference to multimillionaires.
Wait, Bill. Sorry to interrupt, but let me stop you at that point to say maybe that was true. It's possible that Obama could have stared them down, and Republicans, just like Republicans got blamed when the government shut down in the 90s, it's possible that at that point Republicans would have been blamed. But now that everybody in America knows Obama struck a deal with Republicans and that Republicans are willing to compromise, they're not going to stand in the way of this, and that Obama wants this deal, now I don't see how anything that – if this deal doesn't go through, I don't know how anything happens other than the Democrats being blamed.
Oh, I was going to make the exact same point. At this juncture –
right. At this
the
juncture,
people who would be killing the deal would literally be the House Democrats. I mean, it would be fair to say all Democrats, but it would be the House Democrats that would have been the proactive body killing the deal. So how could you possibly shift blame to Republicans at that point? I do not see how one could do that. My earlier point in the blog post that I wrote was that all of this speculation, who would get the blame, is just that, speculation. It's possible. It is certainly possible that you could play the game in such a way that Republicans would take it on the chin. But
right.
As we've also seen in the past year, it tends to be the guy at the very top that gets the blame no matter what.
Not with the government shutdown, though, Clinton. But here's the thing. I think you're right. I think it's a coin toss. Before the deal was announced, it was a coin toss as to who would have gotten the blame if no deal
was reached. You just don't know. It's an unknown.
But now that the deal has been announced, I think it's like 90% likely that Democrats get blamed if nothing happens.
My argument was, you have 13-month jobless aid extension in hand. you have $300 billion of effective additional stimulus in hand, where your prospects of getting additional stimulus over the next 2 years was zero, and the state of the economy is almost certainly the fulcrum of whether not just Obama lives or dies, but I would even make the grander argument whether liberalism lives or dies in the next generation. You want to do everything you can, and not to say $300 million of stimulus is the end-all, be-all of the economy, but it's more than zero.
Well, the other thing I would say, though, Bill, is going back to who gets blamed, though. I said it was a 90% likelihood that Democrats will get blamed. I hold out the 10% that Republicans could just screw up, because I'm not convinced that they have the communications ability even handed such a good hand. But honestly, I can't imagine anything better that could happen. Politically speaking, putting aside what's best for the country, but just talking politics here, I can't imagine a better scenario than Republicans wanting to work across the aisle with President Obama to extend unemployment benefits and to give tax cuts, and for the Democrats to come in and blow that, and for everybody's tax rates to go up, and for people unemployed to be without money at Christmas. I mean, I can't imagine a better. And then Republicans for the next 2 years could basically, hold everything and just keep saying, we've tried, to work with President Obama in the past. And, it seems to me like a no-brainer, but.
Part of the issue on the left is that the trust level with President Obama has really hit rock bottom. You take, for example, this one issue. One of the reasons why this would be additional stimulus is the payroll tax, 1 year reduction, the payroll tax. And this is an issue in the past that has sort of split the left, because on one hand, the payroll tax is essentially a regressive tax. It's a flat tax on workers, and even more than it's capped at around $100,000. So the more you make, the less percentage-wise you pay. So people have often argued, we need to reform this, so it's not regressive. So working is not regressively taxed. On the other hand, it's directly linked to the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. And some people who defend Social Security would say, wait a second, if you're going to jeopardize the soundness of the funding stream for Social Security, you are opening it up for further attack by those forces that want to gut it anyway.
Right.
And because
which is, I would just do means testing on Social Security, but that would be one.
Well, that's
solution.
There are proposals along those lines in what came out of the White House Deficit Commission,
right?
And because the left has been so virulently against the whole Deficit Commission process and very much against the Social Security benefit cuts that are in the Simpson-Bowles plan. There has been a worry/presumption that Obama wants to do that in full. And therefore, there's less trust around the payroll tax piece, because it's now seen as a step towards making an argument for the Simpson-Bowles Social Security cuts. Now, Obama hasn't actually embraced that part of the package yet. He hasn't embraced any aspect of the package yet. We'll know more what he actually embraces, presumably in a month or so, when he puts out his next budget proposal. But because that trust level is so low, my colleague at Campaign for America's Future, Richard Eskow, attacked that part of the deal very stridently. Same with Joan McCarter and Jed Lewison over at Daily Kos.
Why though? Why is it so low? Why? I mean, I don't understand why liberals aren't happy with Barack Obama. I really don't.
I'm unhappy
with him, but I'm a conservative. I have to be unhappy with him.
I've tried to explain this to other of your cavalcade of guests in your absence. And I'm not one of those people.
So this isn't
who
the first
has that strong level of distrust, but
okay.
I certainly know folks who do. And there's been this notion that at every step of the way that Obama did not set a proper high bar mark in the stimulus debate. He should have asked for more in the first place, and he took Larry Summers' advice and lowballed it. They didn't fight for the public option in the healthcare battle. They didn't fight for capping the size of banks in the Wall Street debate. They didn't vocally fight for the carbon cap. They didn't vocally fight for immigration reform.
I just wonder if being so hard on him may backfire. I mean, at some point, he may go full Clinton on you. He may triangulate for real and just say, I'm not going to please these people. I'm not going to make the left happy. And let me just say
he's openly said.
Well, the professional left and all that.
That he's not going to do things to make this portion of the left happy.
Said that.
But I don't see from him abrupt jerk, right word, I think, in the way that Clinton did post 94. I mean, Obama has essentially, people don't want to, hear this all the time, but Obama ran in the first place as a compromiser.
Right.
He argued he was going to have a different approach to compromising.
And you're right, and that's why a lot of Americans voted for him, Bill. That's why a lot of conservatives and just average Americans voted for him. And then I would argue he didn't do that the first 2 years. Now he's
whereas I would argue it's exactly what he did do.
Right. Well, that's where we may see things differently. But let me just say this about going forward about this whole the cult of toughness. I think there's nothing tougher than standing up to your own base. I mean, I know there's this notion that he's not tough enough to stand up against Republicans. I mean, I would argue that facing down your own side really takes toughness. I mean, for what that's worth.
Well, that's always been sort of the thumbnail criteria. And I'm not lumping you in as the establishment Washington pundit class.
Go for it. Go ahead.
But I think your David Broders of the world have always, measured the man or measured the woman. If you stand up to your base, if you have a sister soldier moment, as it's been known in Washington since Clinton, took a swipe at the rapper Sister Soldier, that shows you are a courageous politician. And that notion has been virulently.
Yeah. Well, see, I have a double. I know I have a double standard on this one because I want conservatives to buck the establishment, but I want Obama to come to the center. In a way, it's consistent. Ideologically, it's consistent, but in a way, it's inconsistent.
Right. And so a lot of the left critique that is distrustful of Obama is this notion that he feels like he's never fighting for the base. He's always selling them a little short. And even a notion that maybe he's even gleeful in doing it after the comments like Robert Gibbs is swiping at the professional left. And now what Obama said this past week at his press conference about public option, that deepens this rift that exists. Personally, I don't think this notion of standing up to the base or strongly fighting for the base either way is the measure of strength or weakness. To me, the main measure is, are you trying to tackle the tough problems?
Right.
And I wrote a post a bit back saying, look, you could certainly argue that it would be a testament of strength for President Obama to say, public option, do or die. I will risk my entire presidency. When I ran and said, judge me whether I get health care passed or not, whether I had a successful first term. He said that in the campaign. Put that all on the line to say, if public option's not there, no deal. I would fully agree that is a testament of strength. At the same time, it is just as strong to go to the insurance lobby and go to the drug lobby. And go to Blue Dog Democrats and try your damnedest with moderate Republicans and say, how do we comprehensively solve this problem and find common ground? The act of trying to pass comprehensive reform legislation is strong. What is weak is ducking the issue, which is what most politicians do.
There's a couple
risk either way in trying to tackle a tough problem. Obama tried to tackle it. took it on the chin in a lot of ways. Not like he had some glide path to put in greatness after cutting these deals.
A couple quick points there, Bill.
That's what's been strong about his presidency.
First of all, he, you know, he was just thrashed at the polls in November because he went too far. And people say he didn't go far enough. Should have pushed for the public option. He, you know, what just happened to Democrats in the polls is because Obama, I think, overreached. And because
I don't think it's a question of, you know, doing too little or too much. There is risk in trying to comprehensively solve problems because invariably the specifics of what you want to do will not make certain people happy. And no one can fully judge the measure of what you've done until it's fully implemented, which can't be done.
Look, I think if he had come, it's so debatable. Neither of us can prove our point, but I think if he had come in and been post-partisan, worked on trying to fix the economy, I feel like he would have done better in the midterms. And maybe I'm wrong. Nobody knows.
I had this discussion with my Tea Party mother-in-law yesterday.
Does she still like me?
Why didn't Obama focus on the economy more? Well, the Recovery Act was focusing on the economy for 2 years in one bill. I mean, that was the very first thing out of the box. It just did it all in one day.
All right.
And then the money was, distributed out over the course of the next 2 years.
We're not going to solve this debate,
that's not
Bill. But
lacking focus.
But let me just shift focuses and make it blogger-centric here. Okay, bloggers obviously can impact things, and we have a voice, and I feel like you have two weapons. You have the carrot and the stick, right? And I see this, by the way, with people who are commenters or tweeters who criticize me, and I'm not the president. I don't get near the criticism, I'm sure, that politicians do, but I even see this. And I think people are so quick to be critical. And I think that bloggers are so quick to use the stick, so to speak. I don't think that we use the carrot enough. And I'm talking about not necessarily journalists as much as like activist bloggers, right? So, you know, bloggers who aren't trying to be to cover the news so much as they're trying to actually impact public policy. I feel like they're so quick to criticize, but that they're not quick to praise or to reward politicians when they do the right thing. And I think sometimes this criticism could actually have an adverse effect and that there could be unintended consequences. What say you to that theory?
Well, I do see in the liberal blogosphere when there are politicians that do exactly what said blogger wants to see done, you do see posts saying, you know, have so-and-so's back, send this guy money, send this person email, thank them for X, Y, and Z. But there was an organized campaign to send Nancy Pelosi flowers, at what bill she shepherded through.
You know who did that, by the way? We'll give them some praise if you remember. I don't want to put you on the spot.
I don't. I'm sorry, who was it?
Do you know which blogger it was who we could always find that later? Who had the campaign to send Nancy Pelosi flowers?
I forget off the top of my head, but there's always been things like that. You know what you, and I think our blogosphere master Bob Wright had an essay about this on the New York Times website. There's no organized blog attempt to praise folks for compromising,
right.
Which you can't think of any bill ever that was did not have
praising somebody for compromising bill is like giving them people in the Marines an award for not going into battle or whatever that idea was. Dennis Kucinich's Department of Peace. I mean, you're not moderation is not praise. But I will say this: even the people who on the ideological sides, the conservatives and the liberals. I mean, if I could just say. Personally, and I'm not Nancy Pelosi and I'm not Barack Obama, but just as a writer, if people want to work me, they're not doing a good job. If I write something that's conservative, which I do quite often, I don't hear much. Not a lot of conservatives are really happy with it. If I write something that goes off, you know, defies conservative orthodoxy in any way, then I hear about it. And so now it becomes a matter of, no, first of all, it's best to not let them determine you know, you don't want to let the audience decide what you're going to write about, but let's just say that you do. So you have a choice to make. You can either try to please the audience, or you can defy them. And I would submit to you, Bill, I think a lot of people, sort of like the David Brocks of the world, maybe the David Frums, I don't know, people who at one point were conservative and then became more liberal or changed, I bet you that some of them were pushed by the people who were criticizing them, meaning to keep them more conservative, actually pushed them out the door. So, for what it's worth.
Well, and one thing that we've learned in the, that I think certain liberal bloggers have learned, is that when they are criticizing their own party from the left, they can potentially be more effectual, they have more impact in the discourse. If you have a post saying, like say my own, Barack Obama cut a pretty good tax cut deal, that doesn't, change the discourse.
Right.
An organized blast of prominent bloggers. I'm not saying this is being done insincerely, but that is going to make more of a ripple. The traditional media is going to pick up on that more because wherever there's a rift in something,
right?
Wherever there's some conflict,
and the Obama people were probably smart. By you were quoted in that White House press release. I don't think this is the reason they did it, but in a way they were rewarding you by mentioning you, and that could have spawned some news coverage. So.
There was an actual press statement that was sent out. I was rounding up whatever commentary the White House could find that was in favor of the deal.
Right.
I can only suggest the fact that they included my post might have meant that they were Trump. they did include me, and they did include Steve Kornacki from Salon. They did include Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. I do think it's interesting that the White House is citing blog posts in their professional.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't only blog posts in the thing. They had economists and they had newspaper editorialists as well. But they cast a wide net to try to show, hey, there's a lot of voices out here that like this. And I don't mean to suggest that they're grasping at straws. I do think in one sense that they're grasping at straws in the blogosphere because there were so many of us that were for it. But we actually don't know yet what the broader public thinks of this. There has not, at least as we tape this, there's not been a poll done about the entirety of the deal. There was one poll that I saw that came out that got spun as opposing the deal, but it was taken over the course of the negotiations. So some of the polling was even done before the deal was announced. And the negative part of it was asking about the one provision. Do you think the tax cuts for the wealthy should be extended? Well, we've always known that was generally unpopular. No one had polled, what do you think about taxes for the wealthy along with middle-class tax cuts, along with a payroll tax holiday, along with a 13-month jobless aid extension, along with affordable tax credits on a host of issues? No one's done that poll. It may have a surprise number in it. It may just be that the critique you're getting in the blogosphere is not reflective of where the rest of the country is. It may be that the blogosphere critique has influenced the rest of the country. It might be a more negative reaction from the broader public than would have been if bloggers weren't around. I mean, you can never prove them one way or the other. The blogosphere critique has gotten enough media attention that it certainly shapes the rest of the media coverage and might shape people's perceptions.
This might be a good time to segue because you're talking about how bloggers can get attention for being critical of something. And Jane Hampshire was critical of this Korea trade deal, and she did get a lot of attention. Now, I don't think that's why she did it, but if you're quick and critical, you can get attention. Tell us about that.
I think Jane is a good example of sort of entrepreneurial blogging. She gets ahead of issues sometimes. Before the rest of the media or the rest of the blogosphere catches up, and she doesn't just dip her toe in the water. She tends to dive in head first. So you have Obama was in Asia a few weeks ago. And did not come to an agreement on a Korea trade deal, tried to hold out for a better deal for American car companies and the beef industry. And there was, it was front page in the papers, you know, Obama, you know, oh, sad sack Obama, yeah, after this awful election, he can't cut a deal in Korea, how awful it is to be the president, he has no juice anymore. A few weeks later, he cuts the deal, and upon announcement, gets the endorsement from the United Auto Workers Union. And the White House very eagerly sent that press statement out on its list. And almost immediately, instead of reacting and saying, oh, a major union is on this deal, maybe Obama actually follow through on his pledge to, you know, not just take any old trade deal, but cut better ones. The immediate reaction on the part of Jane was, this is an awful deal. The UAW is, the UAW president is corrupted in some way by flacking for the president on this. And essentially challenging the AFL-CIO president, Richard Trumka, and the Steelworkers president, Leo Girard, say, if you are going to faithfully represent your memberships, you better oppose this. Now, you know, as far as I know, Jane is not a membership of either of these unions. So she's making a gut call that she does know what these memberships want. I'm not saying she's wrong, but it's not like she organized the poll or anything. She's making she's trusting her gut instinct. And as of today, whether or not it's because Jane made this very public campaign to pressure them, it wasn't just a single blog post, it was a series in extremely tough language. It was not sort of asking Richard Trumka and Leo Girard nicely to oppose the deal. It was, you know, damn near close to a threat. But the AFL-CIO and the steelworkers have now opposed the deal, even though the UAW is for it and also the United Food and Commercial Workers Unions are for it. Now you have an open split in the union movement. Now, you could certainly argue that maybe Jane is a non-factor in this and their memberships were already going to be opposed to it. And, that this all would have played out in exactly the same way. Again, it's hard to know these things.
Right.
But I do think it's notable that, when I first saw those posts, I thought that perhaps Jane might actually push them the other way. I'm not going to be bossed around by a freaking blogger. I was not even a member of my union. I'm going to do what I think is right. But certainly that it only could have added to the pressure that is on them to have opposed this deal. And at the bare minimum, it certainly didn't. Jane got the desired result that she was looking for.
Well, speaking of, you said you don't know if it was right or wrong or which way it would go. Bloggers often face this, as you know, Bill. And sometimes we do get it wrong. And wanted to talk about that. Tim Carney, who's at the Washington Examiner, issued a challenge to us, Bill, to not just you and me, but all bloggers. He tweeted, "I propose a new tradition for bloggers, online writers, an end-of-year post going over three things you got wrong in the past year." Bill, I took him up on that over at Politics Daily, and I wrote about three things I think I got wrong. I'll share one of them with you in a second, but first, what do you think of this, and will you be writing your own three things Bill Scher got wrong in 2010?
I don't know if I'll write it out. I'm happy to talk about it here.
It's called the airing of the grievances. What's that? It's part of the it's like the airing of the grievances. It's part of the festivist tradition.
Festivist tradition.
Yes.
You know, when I was doing justliberaloasis.com, I made a point whenever I was provably wrong to say so at that moment and try to then explain why I think I did get it wrong. I try to do it as I go, as opposed to saving it for the end. I haven't done that as much lately. And also a lot of my blogging lately, because I've been so humbled by the amount of times I do get it wrong, I've tried to be a lot more careful and not presuming I know more than I do and to talk about all the uncertainties that are out there in the world. But one thing I did get wrong this year was I did presume that upon passage of healthcare, that Democratic prospects would improve, that poll numbers would instantly go up.
Yeah. you did get that wrong, and we fought about that right here on Blogging Us. And I darn it, I told you. And you were like, because remember, Bill Clinton came in. By the way, you're not the only one who got it wrong. Bill Clinton got it wrong. He's the one who said that the next day the polling would go up by 10 points or something.
And I don't think it's the same as saying, you were right.
I think I was right. But
I mean, you didn't see their poll numbers plummet afterwards. It seemed to be greeted with the bit of a shrug by many, or the dose of skepticism and cynicism. The polling for the bill itself is still pretty split.
If I wasn't so lazy, Bill, I would pour through the annals of bloggingheads.tv, and I would find the clip. And maybe there's a resourceful person out there who could. I mean, God knows they put together all these montages. Maybe somebody would find the clip where I think we probably talked about this on several occasions, but I would love to revisit
the point of my wrongness is, I mean, I don't think my wrongness is that it was a bad bill and they shouldn't have passed it. You know, that to me is not the lesson from my wrongness. The wrongness is, and I think where Bill Clinton's wrongness was, I think there was a time when trust in government was a little higher than it was today. And the act of doing something and having an accomplishment was instantly embraced. And now that broad-based skepticism, and I think this is different than being ideologically pro-government or anti-government, just general skepticism of the system as it is, which cuts across ideologies. The act of doing it does not get you instant love. You got to prove it. It's got to be in place. It's got to be helping me tangibly right now before I will give you my approval. And because they pushed the bulk of the invitation out to 2014, you're not going to be able to assess what the public thinks of it for some time. So that's where my wrongness was this year, predominant.
Well, I will have excuses for my wrongness, too. The biggest thing that I got, which I think is provably wrong, is although I had been very skeptical and critical of Christine O'Donnell, I lavished praise on her TV ad where she says, "I'm not a witch, I'm you. I'm nothing you've heard." You know the ad. I thought it was a great ad. It was produced by Fred Davis. It turned out to not be a great ad. Now, here's where my argument comes in. I actually think, in and of itself, in a vacuum, it was a good ad. I still believe that the ad could have worked, but the problem was that by the time the ad came around, well, number one, let's accept one thing going in. If you've said you're a witch and you have to do an ad saying you're not a witch, you start off at a disadvantage, right? So inherently, when the ad started, she had dug a hole she had to climb out of. I thought the ad was good, but what I didn't factor in was that she had gone national at that point and that the ad would receive national mockery. And so I think that really skewed any sort of impact the ad would have. But I think provably I was wrong that the ad did not work. She was down when the ad aired, and she was down when Election Day came around. It's hard to quantify exactly, but clearly it was not a cure-all for her campaign. I think it's fair to say.
I think there were other ads in the cycle that sort of took vulnerabilities head-on that did work. So it's not necessarily that the basic concept of the ad was inherently wrong. Perhaps the execution of it was wrong. Perhaps there's some inherent weaknesses of the candidate that we're just not going to be able to overcome. General weirdness of being calling yourself a witch in the first place was a tough one to get your arms around. But for example, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, and an ad that I believe I mocked at one point, there were a lot of Republican candidates who are calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme, which in a lot of years, might be, a death knell comment to make. And polling still shows that cutting Social Security is one of the worst positions a congressperson can take, a candidate can take, and that cuts across parties and ideologies. But Johnson put a little wrinkle in his earlier comment for his ad where he said, my opponent's going to say I said Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. Well, I did say that because of the way that they're funding it.
Right.
is a Ponzi scheme, as opposed to saying that the actual concept of the program itself was a Ponzi scheme. So which I would argue was a bit of a sleight of hand from what he originally said. Nevertheless, he took it on head on, and he diffused it as an issue in the campaign.
Let me say, I also got wrong. I thought there's no way that Murkowski wins a write-in campaign. Turns out she probably did, like 99.99% did.
But we all know because of Acorn.
Yes. But yeah, I tell you what, and let me just encourage all the bloggers out there, do this. Go through and do an accounting. If you don't do it as you go, I mean, I sort of do mentally, but I don't. It just depends the kind of blog you have, right? Whether or not you can just put a sentence up or go back in and, you know, update things or however you do it. But do an accounting of the past year, because I was actually pleasantly surprised. I was pleased to see that I think I got a lot more right than I got wrong.
I thought you had one more on your list that I remember reading and thinking you didn't get that.
Well, okay, so I had to pick three things that I got wrong.
All right, what was your third?
And there were actually sort of four, but the last two are debatable. So number three is I had a theory called red herring candidates, and the theory is that not ready for primetime candidates, say like O'Donnell and Sharon Angle, my theory was that they actually helped more serious conservative candidates like Toomey and Rubio. See, if the only three candidates in the world were Charlie Crist, Marco Rubio, and Pat Toomey, you could portray Pat Toomey and Marco Rubio as being too conservative. But because you've added, and it's called the Overton window, you can Google that, but essentially, Angle and O'Donnell expanded the Overton window. I think I'm using the term correctly. And so basically, they took all the attention that might have been directed at saying Rubio and Toomey are too conservative. That was diverted to all of this like tabloid coverage of O'Donnell and Angle. And so simultaneously, Rubio and Toomey appeared to be more moderate and certainly more serious, as I think they were, at least the latter part. But here's where I think I may have gotten it wrong. I think that it's possible that O'Donnell hurt Toomey because what I didn't factor in was the geographical closeness of Delaware and Pennsylvania and the sharing of the Philadelphia media market. So that one has an asterisk, but
I got that
was
wrong? The part that I was going to actually come to your defense on, because I at least heard it anecdotally. I did a radio show in Pennsylvania late in the election cycle, and the host said to me that O'Donnell is making Toomey look moderate. People are seeing O'Donnell in the media market, and Toomey doesn't look like that.
That was my theory going in, but then I remember, and I don't have any empirical evidence to prove this, which would actually be to disprove my theory, but certainly going into Election Day, like the last week, there was a lot of talk. Sestak clearly was trying to tie Toomey or tie O'Donnell to Toomey. That was clearly part of his strategy. I don't know if it worked. I don't know if it may have backfired. Maybe I was right. Maybe I'm wrong because I was right. So that would be a happy deal. Here's the other thing I think I got wrong. It's not so much getting things wrong as it is overplaying things or stories that you think might be a big deal. So, for example, when Ann Coulter wrote a column where she basically said we shouldn't be in Afghanistan, and she, you know, basically – I wrote a piece saying that this could be the beginnings of a schism on the right, the Bill Kristol wing, and you could start to see conservatives like Ann Coulter peel off and become anti-war because it's now Obama's war. It didn't happen. It still could happen.
I don't know if that's an incomplete.
It still could happen, but it didn't happen this year. I always thought if it happens, it wouldn't happen until after the midterm, but I feel less. It seems less likely to happen now than it did when I wrote it. So,
you know, it just takes one thing to go wrong over there for that calculation to change.
You're right about that. Here's but I tell you what, to pat myself on the back here. Two things I think I did get right where I was really ahead of the curve on J.D. Hayworth. I was probably the first conservative to to rightly predict that he could not and probably should not get the backing of conservatives over McCain. And I think I've been ahead of the curve on Rubio, of spotting Rubio. So that's an incomplete. We don't know. Rubio might self-implode. He might not go anywhere. But I think he continues to impress. I think I was probably ahead of the curve in identifying him as a rising star. So that's my end of year accounting, and I would challenge you, Bill, and everyone watching to do the same.
All right. Well, I think that will do it for this week and this week in vlog. Always good to talk to you, Matt.
Good talking to you, and look forward to filling in and being on a semi-regular basis on the weekend blog.
Always good to talk to you. Take care.
All right, man. Thanks.